This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. At the start of his career, Bill Ferris was riding the wave of a new scholarship that valued the voice of the people in the study of history. For decades, he documented Southern African American folklore, and he was the founding director of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. Over the course of 40 years, he talked with writers, scholars, and artists who reflected Southern culture in their work, people like Alice Walker, Pete Seeger, Eudora Welty, and Alex Haley. He recorded many of those interviews, and he collected some of them in a new book. It's called The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. Bill Ferris was once director of the National Endowment for the Humanities, is now a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and senior associate director for the Center of the Study of the American South. And my guest today, Bill Ferris, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Tell me about this book now. 40 years worth of material that you've been collecting over the course of your career. What was it like to go back over that stuff and try to put it into a book?
It was very moving. It was like revisiting my old friends and heroes who were the signposts along the way of my journey to understand the South. Their work and their presence were inspirations for my own.
Tell us about this business, this transformation in scholarship somewhere in the 50s and 60s, let's say, where we began to realize people like John Hope Franklin and Ann Firor Scott, who noticed that there were voices missing from the drama of American history. And you're in the vanguard of this, in a sense. You're coming up when this is still in contention in the academy, but you find it very important to gather the voice of the South. What was that like? What was it that transformed you or made you believe that this needed to be your life's work?
Well, it began as a child on a farm in rural Mississippi, listening to storytellers like my grandfather and black families who lived there. And then it continued in graduate school. I was entranced in Evanston, Illinois, each week to hear Studs Terkel and his wonderful show on WFMT. And my study of the slave narratives and the ex-slave interviews, all of these were worlds that I saw as precious, valuable, and largely inaccessible within the academy.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about Studs Terkel. Here's a guy who gets going during the Depression as part of a WPA project, collects voices, wasn't considered scholarship. It was a kind of a great make-work project that he archived, and then it becomes part of popular culture on his radio show, finally works its way into the academy. And, of course, you grew up in a place where the great collectors of Southern culture lived, not only folklorists, but also artists like Eudora Welty. And you knew her.
Yes, my grandparents were friends of her parents, and as a child, she visited the farm where I grew up, and with a group of artists, they were doing watercolors of the landscape and picnicking. And after they left, my mother told me, "One day you'll know the name of one of these people, Eudora Welty, who is a famous writer." And indeed, later as an undergraduate at Davidson College, I invited her to be our Book of the Year speaker. And to the surprise of all of us, she accepted. And when she arrived, the professors in the English department asked her what made her decide to come. And she said, "Well, I knew Bill Ferris's family, and when he asked, I felt I had to come." And we were friends until her death. I would visit regularly with her whenever I was in Jackson. And she, in many ways, was my inspiration because she had worked with the FSA period as a writer and photographer, and she had taken the voices that I was drawn to as a folklorist and woven them into her short stories and her fiction as a major writer. And so she and all of the people in this book embraced those worlds in ways that inspired my own work.
And she talks about, in her interview with you, talked about her inspiration and how she got going in all of this. Let's listen to Eudora Welty.
"My family always thought learning was a good thing. I was brought up in a good household because we always had books and we always believed in learning and that nothing would be wasted that was spent finding out about things and learning about them. That was a marvelous background. I know we were brought up with the encyclopedia in the dining room, you know, always jumping up from the table to settle an argument, you know, and look up things in the unabridged dictionary, haul out the atlas.
That's Eudora Welty in a conversation with Bill Ferris, who has collected those conversations in his latest book called Storied South, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. You know, but what did what this tells you is she grew up with those books. She also grew up with another narrative about the South and her relationship to it. And that tension, I think, is one of the unique features of Southern writers and Southern artists, a tension between what they learned about the big wide world from mm-hmm. art and culture and literature and what they learned at home from their local communities that they must have found a difficult tension to deal with.
It is a difficult tension, and in a sense, they stand in two worlds, the world of the academy, the encyclopedia, the printed word, and the word of storytelling that is circling them from childhood on. And being able to bridge those two worlds is a key to understanding the American South and the importance of the story, both written and verbal, is a key to what the South is all about.
When I think about some of the great writers in the South, and many of them were your friends and you've collected them in this book, some of the storytelling isn't necessarily a story you want to continue. It's a story that promotes white supremacy. It's a story that promotes white privilege. And those stories are part of family stories, right? I mean, they just get passed down over dinner at Thanksgiving, at holidays. How did these great writers sort of capture the style, the form of storytelling, but have to in some ways jettison the content or the themes that they might have heard?
Well, there's a field in the study of the South now that the University of North Carolina and Fitz Brundage have shaped called the contested memory of the South. So when we say the Civil War was lost, well, whites lost, but blacks were liberated. And these writers and artists in this book reflect that contested memory, the complexity of remembering worlds in which people have very different attitudes towards a place called the South.
Growing up in Mississippi, did you hear all of those stories, or were you hearing many of much of the black narrative as a young man growing up?
I heard a lot of the black narrative on the farm. The families there were black, and I went to a little rural church from the time I was about four with a lady named Mary Gordon, and I felt intimately connected to those worlds. But there were also worlds beyond the farm, which were white. And as I became a teenager and later in college, the civil rights movement was beginning, and I was definitely angry and refusing to be a part of the racism that was part of the worlds in Mississippi. And my work as a folklore scholar and my recordings and photography were inspired in part by an effort to honor those who were invisible, the black families in particular.
Eudora Welty is among the many writers who chose to stay in the South. It's interesting, but you point out in your book, and I think others did as well, that graphic artists in particular would tend to leave the South, whereas writers stayed here. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, the writers could easily have a career by simply mailing a manuscript to New York. And a painter, on the other hand, requires a gallery, a museum. And in the day in which these painters were working, there were almost no galleries. If they wanted a career, they had to go to the Art Institute of Chicago or to New York City or Paris or Italy. And most of these artists did just that. Today, thankfully, the South is a much more nurturing world for visual arts. But in the days of Faulkner, Welty, and Alice Walker, that was not possible. And so you see a migration of the painters out of the South to get to places where they can display and get recognition for their art.
Today on The State of Things, we're meeting Bill Ferris. He's got a new book out, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. He's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's going to be reading tomorrow at 2:30 at the Carolina College for Lifelong Learning at UNC. But with us today on The State of Things, we will find out just what that means to be a Southern writer when we talk with and hear from some of the others in Bill Ferris's book. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Bill Ferris is here talking about his new book, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. Bill's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So we talked about Eudora Welty, who you knew a little bit growing up. She was only lived a couple blocks from you, right? Did you know her? Did you kind of hang out at her house and have tea and cookies when you were?
I did. My grandparents lived a couple of blocks, but I didn't know her really until I was an undergraduate at Davidson College and we first really met.
You talk about the stories of the South and being a Southern writer, and it's interesting because you also talked with Alice Walker, who does not call herself a Southern writer. But tell me about Alice Walker and about your relationship with her.
Well, I first began teaching at Jackson State University in 1970, and my wife at that time and I quickly met all of the people that described themselves as behind the stockade. If you were teaching in the black schools, you immediately met each other. And Alice was writing, and her husband, Mel Leventhal, was a civil rights lawyer, and they had their new baby, Rebecca. And we saw a lot of them. We were very close and have remained close ever since. Alice is an extraordinary figure who continues to probe and to expand through her writing. And The Color Purple for me was a life-changing moment. For the first time, it exposed the issues of black women within their worlds in a way that was truly transforming. And I was honored to work on the film The Color Purple with Steven Spielberg and Quincy Jones. And I've seen Alice over the years. She came here and spoke at the University of North Carolina a few years ago. And so including her in this work was an essential part of my growth as a Southerner and my effort to understand the South.
Giving a full-throated voice to African-American women is what she is known for, and it happened in that book, and then she became controversial within African-American communities, a suggestion that she was somehow demeaning African-American men who had been through enough. This is one of the challenges, right, of becoming a minority, of being a minority voice in this other culture where elements that have been suppressed for so long in the spotlight tend to distort and give a distorted perception, right, to readers, because you have to spotlight something. You have to bring it out.
Sure. Well, if we look at the history of 20th century black literature, we see Richard Wright's Native Son as the first major expression of black rage. We see Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man as showing the invisibility of black culture within the white world. And Alice Walker's The Color Purple turns the spotlight on black women. And those three writers each unveiled to the public a powerful new understanding of the black experience.
It's going to be convulsive, isn't it? I mean, it can't be a sort of a fully balanced picture when you have to spotlight something that has been suppressed for so long.
It's true, and we've talked about Southern literature for so long as white only. When we use the phrase Southern, black audiences think they're talking about whites. And Alice has felt uncomfortable being referred to as a Southern writer. She says, I have no intention of integrating Southern literature. But then she thinks about it and says, but on the other hand, I am Southern, and in my work, I write about Southern worlds. So this is the complexity of the black writer.
Let's listen to what Alice Walker told you.
You see, the reason, I mean, there are many reasons why I'm ill at ease with the Southern thing. I mean, part of it is that any kind of labeling limits, I think. I mean, it tends to make what you're doing seem localized, when in fact, if you're dealing with just characters, if your main focus is to find out why people act the way they do. And Southern writers, when you think of Southern writers, you really think of white Southern writers. I mean, that's what most people think of. I don't really have any interest in sort of integrating Southern writers, you know? On the other hand, how can I possibly ever not be considered a Southern writer since I'm a Southerner and since I write?
Alice Walker talking with Bill Ferris. His latest book is The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. It includes a DVD and a CD so that you can hear some of these voices as well in the full interview. I mean, that is a complex relationship. And also her idea that if you are called a regional writer, it's somehow limiting. And yet I've heard so many writers say just the opposite, that rooting their stories in the particulars of a region is what gives it its universal appeal, if they know what they're doing, right?
This is absolutely true. The story is the universal key to who people are, whether it's a Russian reading Dostoevsky or a Nigerian reading Amos Tutuola, or we might be reading Alice Walker or Eudora Welty. The stories reveal a kind of universal understanding that bonds us as human beings. And no people are more deeply attached to the story than Southerners.
And she does talk about this too. Alice Walker, continuing that interview, acknowledges that this idea of Southern is precisely that. It is a map of the mind. Let's listen.
I think I'm dealing with regions inside people. Although they are, the people are in the South. And in fact, I guess I really just leave that up to other people to decide. I mean, if they can only understand writing by placing it in a context, that's fine. I don't really quarrel with it. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm really trying to understand people and what how they get to be the way they are. So the region is the mind and the heart.
But there is a region that is a Southern region that's a particular one, is it not? Well, how would you, what is that region that is the South that attracts all of us? Writers all over the world are fascinated by the American South.
Well, we can think of that region as three parts. There are the literal Southern states, the old Confederacy. There is the region beyond the region, the diaspora of Southerners, black and white, in Chicago, the Mississippi Delta Blues, and writers like Richard Wright left the South and lived there. There's also the mythic region of the heart, and there is nowhere around the globe that people have not been touched by William Faulkner, Elvis Presley, Martin Luther King. So the South is a complex and powerful story. And when we try to peel that onion and raise the dipstick and check it, the story is where we have to begin.
And don't you think, Bill, I mean, because we're all really struggling with these kinds of tensions within us, the complexity of what we were taught growing up and how it doesn't always comport with what we see or how we feel, every human being struggles with that, and no place on earth, perhaps, has that epic struggle been played out with such drama, right, and so ready for story than in the South. And so it's always all of our story, but nowhere has it been more bloody and more dramatic than the blue and the gray and the struggle here in the South.
It's true. And if we look at James Joyce's relationship with Ireland in his novel Portrait of the artist as a young man. His character, Stephen Dedalus, says that he fled the nets of family, religion, and politics. And in the South, we can add race to that. But all people struggle with the place they come from or live in. And those stories are what bond us as human beings. And certainly the South struggle, which continues today, Faulkner remarked that in the South, the past is never dead. It's not even past. The way it stays alive in a haunting, powerful way is through the story.
Alice Walker herself was influenced by Russian writers, right? Tell us more about that.
Well, it's interesting. Alice, Ernest Gaines, Eudora Welty all talk about their effort to write about the South and that they found the models for doing that not in other Southern writers but in Russian writers who wrote about the villages and the little communities that they read about in Gogol and Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov. They were drawn to those writers as a key to unlocking their worlds, black and white, in the South.
When we think about those great writers, they, it seems to me, and I don't want to reduce their work to anything this simple, but a central element at the core of much of that writing was the wrenching change, the bringing Russia into modernity from those ancient, nearly ancient, if not medieval, villages.
It's true. You have dramatic change from serfdom and slavery to the modern world. And the conditions of the serfs and the slaves were haunting in the minds of the writers who realized the injustice and through their literature tried to grapple with those issues. And certainly that is part of what bonds the South and Russia in such a powerful way.
And when you put it that way, it makes it more obvious why we would all be attracted, because in the American North, it looked more modern, it looked more industrial, but we were no more emotionally and mentally prepared for the stresses of modernism and modern life than anybody else. It's just that we maybe pretended better. There were more factories here, so we looked more modern.
It's true. But you carry those places with you, the farms that Southerners grew up on. Robert Palmer, my friend, who interviewed Muddy Waters for a Rolling Stone interview in Chicago, told me that after the interview, Muddy said, "Bob, I want to show you my garden in the backyard on the south side of Chicago." And they walked out, and Muddy had growing there cotton, okra, corn, all the plants that he had transplanted from his world in the Mississippi Delta were growing in Chicago. And Southerners carry those worlds to other places. And the way they carry them, if you look at where they live, is through books, through recordings of music, and through paintings and art. And a Southerner outside the South predictably will have a living quarters that is surrounded with Southern images and sounds and literature. Again, those stories are kept alive by the people in this book.
In the tie that binds, it seems to me, in an older culture, that sort of, I've used the word modern, so I'll stick with it. It's not so much the technology, but the way people relate to each other. So the family ties, the social connections that mark the economy of the South are broken. They're destroyed in a modern economy that has become commodified, and where markets are worshipped as some kind of a god, and human social contact is, given a secondary and tertiary position. That may be the central feature or the central tension, it seems to me, that we find in some of this literature, international and Southern as well.
It's true. And here in the Piedmont, you see the development of mills and rural, predominantly white Southern families moving from the country to the towns like Gastonia, and longing for that rural world, And you see the old-time country bands of Charlie Poole and others bringing that emotion in the music to them. So right here in Durham, in Chapel Hill, in Carrboro, we have dramatic examples of what the story did to keep alive those rural worlds and families that found themselves working with a clock rather than from dawn to dark to earn their living.
When we talk about bringing those voices alive, alternative voices, voices that are not part of the scholarship of history, at least up until the last half of the 20th century, Alex Haley is probably the guy who did more to bring it into popular culture than anybody else. Tell us what you knew about him and your friendship with Alex Haley.
Alex got it from the very beginning. He saw what we now call Southern Studies as a way of approaching the South academically. And his two books both transformed my life. The Autobiography of Malcolm X and Roots were two powerful new ways of seeing the black experience in America. And Alex had a deep love for the South. He sought me out early on, and we became friends. We traveled together, and he hosted a group of my friends for a weekend on his beautiful farm in Norris, Tennessee. And he saw the South as a homeland for black and white, and he saw a vision of bonding all of the old divided worlds in a new South that would be truly new and truly reformed by stories. And no one could tell stories more eloquently and movingly than Alex.
Let's listen to Alex Haley.
I'm influenced in whatever I say by the fact that I innately love the South. I really truly think it's the best place in this country to live. I like the people. People are kinder, more, and we are certainly better raised than most of the people I've met from other parts of the country. You were showing a picture this morning, and I'm particularly moved by hands, people's hands doing things. Or if you look at the hands of old ladies, it said that women's hands in particular show their age and their, what their life has been like more than anything else about them. And I just feel the South is a place of hands. It's a place of touch, of caress, of less of slapping and knocking people down. It's a softer, sweeter culture on the whole.
There's Alex Haley, one of the many voices you will hear in the storied South, the voices of writers and artists, Bill Ferris's latest book. Interesting to hear the contrast between how Alex Haley sees his work as something that does bring people together and Alice Walker, who says, look, I'm doing my job, but I have no interest in integrating Southern writers, as she says. A big contrast there.
It is, and it's interesting that this whole idea of the contested memory of the South and contested views exists not only between black and white figures, but between black figures. Sterling Brown, for example, a wonderful poet whom I interviewed in this book, was very uncomfortable with the South and the violence that lurks beneath the surface, and was very critical of parts of William Faulkner's work that he said did not look fairly at the black experience. So you have a full range of voices, and my thought was these are figures who never met, never really had a chance to know each other, and what a wonderful dream it would be to have them all at a common table of conversation, speaking to each other. That would have been so much fun, and I'm going to do that in this book as an homage to each of them so the reader can be at that table and listen thoughtfully to what they were thinking and doing.
Bill Ferris, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. That's his latest work. He's going to be reading tomorrow, but right now he is our guest on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, and our program will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Bill Ferris is here. His new book, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. It is a collection of interviews with luminaries of the South, Eudora Welty, Alice Walker, many, many more. DVD and CD is part of the book. And Bill is a professor at the University, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And one of the writers who really fascinates, I mean, all of these writers are amazing, and it's your collection of stories from them is wonderful. Ernest Gaines is a writer who in many ways for me is unique in the way he can bring me into African-American communities and show me the tensions within those communities in ways that I think as an outsider might never have known.
It's true. And I've known Ernest Gaines since the early 70s when Alice Walker introduced us. And he had just published the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. And what struck me, and I brought him into my classes at Yale in 1972, and when we met, he said, you know, I knew about you, and I always thought you were black. And I said, well, that is a great honor. I hope you will, you know, respect what I do, and I know that I respect you. And what struck me about Ernest Gaines is his ability to go beyond race and to create relationships in his characters of black and white who are in love with each other and who clearly encounter the impossible worlds of living in a racist world that will not allow their love to be consummated. This is a rich and beautiful way of looking at the story of the South. And Ernest Gaines, like many black writers, Alice Walker, Sterling Brown, lived outside the South and wrote as expatriate writers. And in Ernie's case, he more recently has come back home. And my wife, Marcy, and I visited him and his wife, Diane, at their lovely home in Louisiana, which was built on land that his ancestors farmed as slaves. He has renovated and moved the old church, schoolhouse that he worked in as a child to their property and renovated and restored the graveyard. So he has reclaimed his little postage stamp of native soil, as Faulkner would say. And over his desk in his study is a photograph of William Faulkner. Mm. So this underscores the complexity and the richness of Ernest Gaines for me.
And so beautiful, the way he can give you intimate portrayals of African-American life, and yet it feels so inclusive. It is directed at. I've always felt that this is work that was meant for me as a white man to read. I want Frank... Ernest says, you know, in my mind, whatever, you need to read this. And not all authors present themselves that way. Sometimes I feel like I'm looking at somebody else's diary, you know, and it wasn't really meant for me. This is, and yet it's the most intimate portrayal of African-American life that I've ever read. And he manages to do both. Do you think he had to go away to get that kind of perspective?
I think he did. He left as a very young teenager and grew up in Vallejo, California, and studied at Stanford University, but he found himself returning to the voices and stories of his family and community. And when he was crafting the character of Miss Jane Pittman, he said that he finally began listening for the voices. He said, my friends will think I'm crazy when I say that, but I listened for those voices and began to write them down. And each day they would come back to me and I would continue writing. This is a graphic way of understanding the power of the story and of the human voice. The voices of his family were the foundation on which he built his fiction, along with his discovery that Russian writers were the models through which he was able to reconnect to his own community in Louisiana.
You talked about his restoring his church, and you talked earlier about going to black churches or a black church when you grew up. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was very powerful. I was about 4 when I first went, and the hymns there were all sung without hymnals from memory. They were a cappella, and the whole church almost would rise from the ground, you know, with the sound of that deep, powerful voice and the preacher preaching. The sermon and the hymns were sounds that I will never forget that inspired my work as a folklorist, because I realized as I grew older that since there were no hymns, when the families were no longer there, the music would disappear. And I began to record and to photograph those worlds that led me to my work as a folklorist.
Well, here's one of those recordings. This was taped in 1968 at the church on your family's property in Mississippi. There's a little bit of a tape that Bill Ferris collected in 1968 in a church. And, Bill, I understand that you had quite a few of those tapes, and they played an important part in your career once you had a shoebox full of those.
They did. When I found my way to the folklore department at the University of Pennsylvania, my advisor was Kenneth Goldstein. And at our first meeting, I took a box with these tapes and my photographs to him. And I said, "Dr. Goldstein, can I study this material here?" He looked at me and he said, "My boy, that will be your dissertation. Keep doing it." Oh. And so that was like a door swinging open for me.
When you talked about Ernest Gaines saying that, you know, he thought you were black because he'd read your work and that sort of thing. But what about this business of white explainers, you know, the white folks who become fascinated by and have a deep interest and love in this kind of tradition? Do white folks have the right to be the curators and interpreters of this work?
Well, I think anyone who tries to preserve this work deserves credit and support, whether black or white. If 100 years from now we can hear blues recorded 100 years earlier by Howard Odum and Guy Johnson that's housed in Wilson Library, we should thank them. And I also think that whiteness and blackness should be a figment of the imagination. We are all human beings, flesh and blood, and the study of the South needs to be founded on that understanding, the study of the story. We shed the sense of who is speaking and who is recording and look more deeply at a portrait of a people, black and white, increasingly Hispanic and Asian, all of whom are drawn to these places and transformed by what Eudora Welty calls the sense of place. And so the recordings are so important, and we need to do more of them in every generation to mark the history of our people.
Race may be a biological fiction, but it's as a social construction, it's very real and deadly in many cases. So I'll get back to this this challenge that as a social construction, it is it makes we have different experiences of the world, and so when people argue with you that, you know, look, you shouldn't be talking about this. This isn't your world, and we don't want to hear it from you. The biological argument is sublime, and I think Trump. But when someone says, "You haven't been in my shoes, and I don't want to hear you talking about my culture and my my experience," what is the answer to that?
Well, the answer is, as a Southerner, this is part of my culture. These are voices that I understand in my heart, that I grew up with. And in order to better understand myself as a white Mississippian born in a privileged family, I need to, as my father would say, walk in the shoes of others. My father told me that you can always learn something from each person you meet. And by reaching out and living with black families in the Mississippi Delta in the 60s, recording their voices and their music, they were teaching me in powerful ways, and they became my students' teachers through my work as a folklorist. And I told and tell my students, follow your heart and you will be both happy and successful with what you do. And that's exactly what I did.
And Pete Seeger is somebody else who's, I think, embraced that philosophy, acted as a bridge, and sang about the common plight and showed particularly poor whites and poor blacks and working class people all over the country how much they had in common, right?
Yes, and Pete is an interesting part of this book. He's one of several people in the book, Walker Evans, John Dollard, and his father, Charles Seeger, who were not born in the South, but whose lives were transformed by his visits here. And Pete came as a very young child to Pinehurst with his parents and later as a teenager to Asheville, where he first heard old-time country and banjo. And that totally changed his life, and he began to dig deeper and deeper into the music of the South and to connect that music to social issues, and was an important part of changing the old traditional hymn, "We Will Overcome," to "We Shall Overcome," which became an anthem of both the civil rights movement here, but also social movements in Tiananmen Square and all over the world.
And here's what Pete Seeger had to say about that.
"And we shall overcome" is very interesting. You know, it doesn't say who they're going to overcome. That's part of the poetry. Incidentally, Charles Tindley wrote another song. It's one of his better known hymns. "By and by, when the morning comes, and all the saints of God go marching home, we will tell the story of how we overcome, and we'll understand it better by and by." Every black church in America knows this song. So again, he used the word overcome without saying who you're going to overcome.
Pete Seeger, one of the many voices you will hear and read in The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists by William Ferris. Bill Ferris is here today talking on the state of things. He's going to be reading tomorrow at 2:30 at the Carolina Center for Lifelong Learning. And I think that's the other message that is carried in all of these conversations, the power of the imagination, creativity, to subvert the dominant culture, to bring about a real or just order, and how all of these artistic elements are so important.
It's true. You can think of the ocean and violent storms on the surface and the quiet, peaceful base of the ocean. That's where the stories lie. They are there throughout time. And we need to tap those stories, which will outlive every political issue that we know, that we struggle with. The stories are what keep us alive and well and allow us, as Faulkner would say, to endure and prevail.
You talked about your love of Southern culture, white and black, and you had your own blues show for a while, right? Your own blues radio show?
Yes, Frank, I'm a big fan of you and everyone who does radio. And so when I was at the University of Mississippi, I had a chance that I jumped at to become the host of Highway 61, a two-hour blues show every Saturday night from 10 to 12, and I became known as the blues doctor. And I would say things like, "If you've got the heartache, the backache, or you just plain lonely, stay tuned, because I've got a blues cure for you right here on Highway 61.
I'm glad you got to do that on the radio again. You met B.B. King.
Yes, B.B. is an old friend. And when I was at Yale, I gave a talk at a Black History conference on blues, and a young woman in the audience came up and said, "I think B.B. King would like to meet you and come to your class. Would that be possible?" And I said, "That would be the greatest honor of my life." So B.B. not only came, he brought his band, he repeatedly returned, and we were able to get him an honorary doctorate of humane letters at Yale. And later at the University of Mississippi, he gave us all his records, which became the basis for the Blues Archive there. And then when I was at the National Endowment for the Humanities, he came and spoke and performed on Lucille, and we put him on the cover of Humanities magazine, the first time that had happened in history. He is the greatest living blues artist, and I'm proud to call him my friend.
We hear so much about the polarization in the national discourse these days, and I'm wondering, with your belief and your faith in the power of story to find the common bond, is there something working under the surface that's making us really closer than we think we are, or is this polarity that we're seeing essential? Are we really being pulled apart, do you think?
Well, we are being pulled apart. We can simply look at the news every day. But I firmly believe, partly as a Southerner and partly as a folklorist, that the story is like a welding torch that will cut through the steel of resistance. And when I worked at the National Endowment for the Humanities, I would go into the offices of both Senator Kennedy and Jesse Helms, and we found common ground. Jesse Helms was interested in country music and mule trading. I gave everyone on the Hill I visited with an encyclopedia of Southern culture, and we didn't talk politics. We talked about stories. Where are you from? Who are your people? What kind of worlds can we enrich through what we do at the National Endowment for the Humanities? And each year we got an increase of $5 million. I think that moves us off the table of political division and into the common ground of the story, which is what this book is all about.
Well, Bill, thank you for enriching our lives with all of your work, including this latest, The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. Bill, thanks for being on the program.
It's an honor, Frank.
Bill Ferris' new book is called The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists. Going to be reading tomorrow at 2:30 p.m. at the Carolina College for Lifelong Learning at UNC. Bill Ferris is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and senior associate director for the Center for the Study of the American South. Join us tomorrow for our live show. We're going to be live at the Triad Stage in Greensboro. RSVP for the free event by going to our website, wunc.org, and click on the Events tab if you want to see us live at Greensboro tomorrow. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.